This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
From the Palmetto Swamps to the Piney Woods to the Oak Flats, you're listening to the Louisiana Bowhunter Podcast.
You're listening to the Louisiana Bowhunter Podcast presented by Scree Gear. That's S-K-R-E, Performance Hunting Apparel. And we want to remind you that the risk-free Whitetail Starter Bundle promotion is still going on. That bundle is a lightweight pant, merino long sleeve top, a vest, merino gaiter, merino gloves, and a Scree cap. And you buy it, you try it for up to 14 days, and if you're not totally satisfied, you return it, and you get your money back. It's that simple. That bundle's got everything you need to get in the tree stand on opening day, and honestly, in Louisiana, probably a lot of the days of the season. And another thing, you can use the code LABH on ScreeGear.com and get 20% off your first purchase. Now, that code won't apply to already discounted sale items or bundles because the bundle packages at Scree are already discounted. But for any other purchases, if you want to fill your cart item by item, get 20% off your first purchase. So check them out, find out more about Scree, follow them on social media, subscribe to their YouTube channel, and you can shop online at ScreeGear.com. So I have Kyler here with me. What's up?
What's going on?
And we have friend, supporter, community prankster, Brian Chamberlain. How are you?
I'm good.
You're not a prankster. You're dead serious with all the crap that you post on the community page, right? So, yeah, we're going to have Brian on today and talk a little bit about it's September, and Brian's done some of the different early season hunts that you can get into outside of the state. We're going to find out a little bit more about some of the hunts that he's been on and just kind of talk about what we're all expecting as we turn the calendar, which reminds me, I'm pretty excited. This is the last week that there's not hunting season. And before anybody gets their feathers ruffled, I realize that even in our state, there are some seasons that open earlier in September. I just took part in one of those. I just took part in one of those myself. This past week, but for me, I don't know how you guys feel, but for me, October the 1st is like a holiday because it doesn't even, it feels different on October the 1st. Do you feel, you guys feel that way?
Yeah. Well, my favorite is, every year I'll post, we post a countdown, and the countdown is until October 1st, right? Mm-hmm. And every year in September, people are like, man, you know, Area 9, Area 3, Area 7. Like we, and I'm like, guys, this is a countdown to a date. This isn't saying that there aren't other times that that bow season begins, but the majority of the state is October 1st. So, and also, I know there's a lot of people that hunt the opener on the west side of the state, but it seems to be every year there's not as hard and heavy of like stick with it, go every day, go every weekend as there is for the rest of the state, because it's just usually just brutally hot.
Yeah,
brutally hot.
Plus,
a lot of times it overlaps with teal season and I think a little bit of dove season. I'm not really a dove hunter, but teal season draws a lot of people because it's so short. But anyway, I agree with you though. I'm pretty excited. 1 week left.
Yep. So, B, I said A. B, I'm excited. This is a little bit off topic, but for all of you that listen regularly to the podcast, if you hear a difference, we have gotten new pod equipment. We've got new podcast equipment, so I'm hoping that the audio quality, I'm excited because it sounds better on my end, and it's much easier to operate, and I'm kind of geeking out on it. It's kinda,
yeah, I'm
it's
pretty pumped.
It's kind of fun. So
it sounds good. I think it sounds good.
It sounds
good. Give me a laugh track. Give me a laugh track.
Okay. Here you go. Y'all ready? Brian, tell us a joke.
Yeah.
Just joking.
You guys know anything about penguins?
Oh, that's so bad, man.
I need one of those in like my daily life.
I know.
Yeah.
Just a glowing green button for somebody to laugh at your jokes.
Yeah. So what happened last week, and I'm sure you'll get to this, Locke, but you went out of state. You went to Missouri.
Did.
You hunted.
Did.
And you brought the podcast equipment, and we had a guest lined up. We're gonna have him this week, at the end of this week, but it kind of crapped out on us.
Yeah.
The equipment did. It's the fourth year. We're getting a lot of feedback. I was actually hearing myself.
Reverb.
Very, very, yeah, really bad reverb, to the point when I was asking Jonathan Moreland,
Bordelon.
Jonathan Bordelon, thank you, last week, my questions, I don't know if you could hear, but like about 10 seconds into my questions, I would kind of lose my frame of thought because I was hearing all the things I just said back. And it was really messing me up. But anyway, we got new equipment. I'm pretty excited about it. It's actually made for podcasting, not made for recording guitar on an iPhone. And we're a fish now.
Yeah, we're
so
a fish.
Pretty cool.
Any other news?
But, so I meant to tell everybody this last week. You and I discussed it, but it's kind of like seeing your first deer of the year. I don't care if it's a fawn or a 120 or a 180. You're going to get shaken up by it, and you're going to forget. You're going to forget how to bow hunt for a second. So I forgot how to record a podcast last time, apparently. But what I wanted to tell everybody officially was that Locke is now a partner in Louisiana Bow Hunter, and not just a co-host and my IT guy and all that stuff. He is now actually a major part of its operation, its function, its daily momentum. And so I want y'all to know that for me, and also to welcome Locke on board, because he's been helping out for years, and now he's officially a partner. So I'm excited to be doing this with you officially, man, and I'm looking forward to growing this even more.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I am too. I'm looking forward to it. And like you said, I've been it doesn't feel that much different. Really, as far as you know, my day to day this time of the year, because I have been heavily involved for a number of years, but yeah,
sure.
It's a great opportunity, and looking forward to doing a lot of cool stuff in the future with the brand.
There's another thing that I want, I guess, let other people know that we're excited about. So the last 2 years I've been growing another business, and it's kind of consumed my life a good bit, and so that's why I reached out to people this year with Louisiana Bowhunter to kind of like take on a little bit more of the operation of it to help grow it, because three people doing it is better than one or two. And so last year, I didn't get all of our merchandise, Louisiana Bohunter merchandise, in all the shops that we were in of the state. I was just kind of overwhelmed with my other business. And so David O'Donnell is actually officially in sales for Louisiana Bowhunter. So if you know of a shop that needs some merch, or a corner store, or a gas station, or a one-stop shop, or whatever, we'd love to get a rack in there. You can send us an email at info@LouisianaBowhunter.com or sales@LouisianaBowhunter.com, and we will get David, we'll bird dog David on there, because he's doing a fantastic job. We've been, I don't want to say we're late on merch this year, because I was really late on it last year, and we got out ahead of it, but the problem is we've put so many hats and decals and shirts in shops already that it didn't have enough to sell on the website. So we just got a second round of inventory refill, and we're still trying to get all that into the shops. But it's now on the website. You go to LouisianaBowhunter.com, check out all the new merch. Really proud of how the designs and the hats and the colors and the themes and styles all came out this year. It's really cool stuff. So we're still working on some shirts, but it'll be here. It's ready to go, but the shirts will be a couple more weeks. So
yes, sir. Cool. So if you hear me, I actually have enhanced mute capabilities with our new equipment. But if you hear me sniffling or sneezing, I apologize in advance. I've been on a tractor for like 7 hours today, and my allergies are on fire. But I'll tell you another thing that happened to me today that's just kind of an aside. And I don't know if either of you have ever had this happen, but I'm bush hogging for a friend of mine. They didn't have access to a tractor this year, trying to help them get all their roads and food plots bush hogged so they can get someone out there to plant them and all that kind of stuff. And I'm going along on my tractor, and I see this very odd hole in the ground. And it's kind of in an area where there's tall grass, but it's sparse, you know, so you can see the ground beneath the even tall grass. And I go over the hole, and I'm just like, well, that's kind of a weird hole. It's like something in it, and I couldn't tell what it was. I kept going. I come back around, and I actually had a pin broke on my bush hog, and I didn't realize, but I was right by the hole. And it was a nest of ground hornets.
Oh, God.
And that's never – I've been stung by them. I actually shot an arrow at a target and missed. That's the only time I've ever missed in my life. But it was like some pine needles, and I was back there with a rake, like raking the pine needles, and got into a nest of ground hornets, and they lit me up, chased me all the way back to the house. But I've always heard these horror stories of people on equipment, specifically this time of the year working food plots and deer leases and stuff, and going over them and just getting lit up before they can get off the tractor. And I got lucky, but it scared me. So the rest of the day I was like, eyeballing everything. So that was
sounds like nightmare fuel, man. That does not.
It is. So I know that you don't have this problem, Kyler, because your style of hunting doesn't require you to do. I want to say a lot of this, but any of this. But Brian, I know you've got some new properties, and you've been busting it trying to get things ready. You ready for opening day?
We're ready for opening day. Yeah,
I've seen your pictures. Though.
I hadn't, my wife will tell you that I'm overly ready just because I've been gone so much, but yeah, I think we're ready to go, but no hornets. Although last year we pulled down a ladder stand, and there was about six or seven of us all sitting around drinking beer. A couple guys are working on the ladder stand, and in a split second, you watch six or seven guys running across the field, swatting their neck, their face, and everything else getting stung. So
yeah, you got to watch box stands, tree stands. I had that happen with my disc, it's tubing, and it was full of wasps when I went to hook up to my disc the other day. So it's that time of the year. Yep. Snakes and bugs. And we've had some nice weather, though. It's been awesome.
Yeah.
It's
going to be – don't worry. It'll be hot for opening day.
Last year it wasn't now. Last year it was really nice on opening day.
Last year was the best opening weekend weather I've seen as an adult.
Yeah.
Like in a long, long, long time.
Yeah.
I remember it was 50 on the dot. It was 50 degrees for three or four mornings in a row. So, and I really think that's why so many people killed velvet bucks that first weekend last year. Remember we talked to Jonathan Bordelon about that?
Yep.
That's pretty deep.
Yep. Weather swap. We're talking about in mentioning, you know, getting ready and prepping land. I want to remind you, if you haven't seen what Slade Priest is up to, Slade is now a Realtree United Country Land Pro and partnered up with Realtree United Country Hunting Properties. And nobody sells more in our area, specifically in the Southwest Mississippi area. And, you know, what makes Slade so unique in what he does is he spent his whole life as an outdoorsman, part of the Trained Assassins hunting television show, and still a part of some of the United Country digital media hunting that you can find online. And he spent his whole life as an outdoorsman, as a hunter. So when it comes to listing recreational hunting properties, he knows exactly what he's looking at. He knows exactly how to market it. So whether you're looking for that piece of land or whether you're looking to list a piece of land, he knows how to pair up with the right buyers and the right sellers and find people what they're looking for in terms of hunting property and recreational property. So you can check him out at huntinglandmanms.com. And he's also got his own podcast where he talks a lot about what he does with this style of real estate. And the passion comes through. Nobody sells more. So we thank Slade for supporting the podcast.
Absolutely.
Kyler, you mentioned my hunt in Missouri. So, you know, what we're going to do with this podcast, you mentioned also that the pod equipment didn't work last week. So, you know, as Brian's normally, he's second fiddle. So we called in Brian from the bullpen to fill in while we tried to stopgap that situation. But that's just part of the story. And what we want to talk about, it actually fits really nice. There are a lot of hunts in September, both in our state and other places. And Brian's been on a few hunts already this year. We want to kind of find out more about how that experience went for him. And as far as me, Missouri, man, you're talking about the weather. And the reason I went, I have access to hunt some property in Missouri whenever I get the chance to go. And with COVID that I went through with myself and my family, and then followed a week later by the hurricane, my early season hunts were just that my plans were gone. I was going to go to Nebraska for Labor Day and hunt that, and I just had kind of given up. Well, we got, and it was 45 degrees low temperature, and it got up to maybe 70 both days I was there. I kind of made a last-minute decision on Friday of last week. I bought some airplane tickets and went up there on Monday and hunted Tuesday and Wednesday. I had a blast. I don't know, you know, how much emphasis do you guys put into moon phase? Like, what are your thoughts about moon phase? And I'll tell you why I'm asking this after you share your thoughts with me.
So my thing is, I've never tracked it that heavily. I will admit I'm not super educated on it, but I do know that, and this is really common knowledge, I do know that I don't see a lot of early morning activity on a full moon, and that's really about the only moon phase that I pay attention to. And I will say that I will hunt a little later, and as I'm getting older, sometimes I won't even go in later on the morning after a full moon, and I'll do like a 9 or 10 a.m. to the rest of the afternoon hunt, or scout all morning and find a spot mid morning. Yeah. So that's about all I ever really cared about. I've never tried to piece it together any more than that.
Brian, do you pay attention to it?
I think it makes sense that, you know, they've got light and it's a little more comfortable out there, and they've got, you know, enough light and they're out feeding and stuff like that, that they wouldn't show up same time during the day, you know, as in other moon phases. But I mean, I think deer, I don't know if you can ever put them in a box, you know, but I would say it's very possible that it has an impact.
So go ahead.
One other thing I do want to say about that. I remember Harmon Carson mentioning on either his first or second podcast with us years ago, talking about how he puts more emphasis on hunting new moon than he does full moon and what to do around a full moon. He thinks that if I'm not mistaken, I think he thinks a new moon is more impactful than a full moon is. So that's just something to throw out there. Ultimately, I need to do more research on it, but I'm going hunting no matter what. That's why I've never said I'm not going at the full moon, you know. Yeah. So
y'all don't subscribe to the red moon calendar?
No, but if you'd kill 200 inch deer if you did, whether they live there or not.
Yeah.
Does that come with the
bottle of Tink 69? It comes with a bottle of Tink 69.
And the black rack.
In a YouTube red video description. Perfect. All right.
So here's why I asked that. All right. So I'm with you, Kyler. I mean, to a certain extent, I'm gonna go hunting and I'm gonna strategize around the information given to me. But I'm gonna go hunting if I want to. Either way, you know. However you want to put that, but. In the event of buying airplane tickets and actually traveling somewhere, you kind of take in all the information you can, right, and decide, is this the time to do it or should I not go now, you know, at least in my situation where I'm able to kind of make that last-minute decision. So there was a full moon while I was there, and I'm talking about one of those kind, like just kind of awe-inspiring, bright full moon, like crazy full. Well, the reason I went was because of the temperature drop. Well, they hadn't had a cold front and gotten the temperatures down like that yet this year. And so you had the high pressure cold front and you had the standing beans. And the concept there is those bigger deer are more likely to show up in the beans in the daylight or be out in the beans after daylight and you can catch them coming back to bed. Basically, the colder weather alters that feeding pattern. And the whole time, I mean, we've seen plenty of deer. We've seen deer doing exactly what they were supposed to do. We just didn't see the right deer. And we had pictures of shooter bucks at 5:30 in the morning and 8:30 at night. So basically an hour before and an hour after, just like they had been all summer. Well, not all summer, but just like their typical nocturnal pattern. And my cameraman, Colin, kept saying, man, I think it might be the moon, you know. And I don't know if he's right or not because, you know, typically when you've got standing beans and you get that first cool front, there's high odds, you know. And it just didn't happen. We didn't even see any out of bow range. The closest thing I got was a 3-year-old 8-point coming back to bed in the morning time. So I don't know. My thought about it is I don't necessarily say that I play the moon, but I do pay attention to it because I think that later in the season, when the deer are on different patterns, the moon does affect their movement. But in my mind, I'm thinking on a summer feeding pattern where we know that they have very, you know, I mean, it's pretty much established that deer have a pretty direct, simple pattern in summer. It's bed to feed, feed to bed, and they don't typically move that far, right? They're usually pretty close to where they're feeding, and later in the season they actually move more and they move longer distances, specifically when you start talking about pre-rut and rut and then post-rut and refueling after and the limited availability of food when the browse and the acorns are going away and all that kind of thing. So I think in that case the moon plays a bigger role. My thought was I ignored the moon because I thought, well, I mean, a cold weather front is going
to
get it.
Yeah, you're paying attention to the weather.
Yeah, I'm thinking that deer's laid up within a couple hundred yards of this bean field, and if this cold weather front's liable to keep him, get him up on his feet before dark, regardless of the moon. But didn't happen.
Well, I'm glad you went, because when you were thinking about going, and I don't know if you were bouncing this off of anybody else, but you had texted me. We were texting back and forth. And you're like, I'm thinking about going to Missouri. I got to, you know, book this and go pretty soon. And typically, most people, when they're on the fence of something like that and it involves doing something major like traveling 14 hours or flying, most people pull back, especially when it involves doing something as involved as traveling a couple of states away, flying, et cetera, and it's just a short trip. And to me, that's where regret comes from. You know, is not doing something. So even though you didn't kill anything, I'm just glad that you went. got that experience, figured this out. Well, you know, maybe in the future it'll save you some money where if these same conditions pop up again, you'd be like, I'm going to sit this full moon phase out, even though, you know, it's an Arctic blast coming or whatever.
Yeah.
So, I like that. It's a compliment because I like your decisiveness there. Most people don't do that. Most people are like, it's hard. I'm not going to go. You know,
there were a lot of there. And I know you and I texted back and forth. There was a lot of that going on in my head. Like, I only got 2 days to hunt and I got a lot
to
do at home.
When people do that, they don't typically go through with it. And when you were like, yeah, book a flight, I'll leave Monday. I was like, hell yeah. Nice.
So let me tell you one really quick story about that. That will even further drive home this spontaneous off the cuff nature that I'm acting on here, which I had no control over this. But so we all know and probably have heard how much damage there is in the La Place area from the hurricane. Power's out. There's no red lights. The few red lights that are working are on like generators, and there's a cop standing there flipping them off and on. So my flight out of New Orleans is at 6 o'clock on Monday evening, and everything's going great. We leave and we're going to be like an hour and a half early. I mean, we're going to be at the airport 2 hours before the flight, plenty of time to get checked in, whatever. We get to, I'm coming up 55 into La Place, and there's an 18 wheeler on fire on the I-10 overpass or the I-10 high rise over Pontchartrain. And the interstate's completely shut down, and they're redirecting traffic through La Place. And it took us, I can't remember now, but long story short, and I swear to you, this is the God honest truth, I pulled my truck into short-term parking, and I hit the lock button and started walking into the terminal at 5:27 with a bow case, a check bag, cameraman with his stuff. We were standing in line to board the plane at 5:35.
What?
How unbelievable is that? We ran. We got lucky. You know those pay for carts where you pay to haul your luggage?
Yeah.
Somebody had left one at the door, so we didn't have to check it or anything. We threw our stuff on there. We sprinted to the escalator. We ran up to check our bags. There was nobody. There was three agents, and one of them was empty. They knew we were in a hurry. They threw our stuff on there. They just kind of gave us that breathe. Hey, you got to hurry. Late check-in, bags aren't guaranteed. I'm like, whatever, good. So nice. We sprint to TSA. We sprint straight to the conveyor belt. There's nobody in line at TSA. Go straight through, sprint to the gate. Literally 7 minutes from the truck to standing in line to board.
That is the least New Orleans story I've ever heard.
And look, we sat in that crap in La Place in traffic for however long that was, from 2 hours, I think, from 3:30. Yeah, because 3:30 we were going to be there at 4. 3:30 to 5:30, basically. And I'm like, I had given up. I was on the phone with Southwest, and I was like, look, what can I do here? I was like, I'm not going to make it in time. She's like, you have up to 10 minutes or something before departure time, and you can cancel your flight at no cost and forward it to another. So I'm like, okay, we'll come back another time and hunt later in the season, and we'll fly then. But she's like, you have to do that with an agent at the airport. You can't do it on the phone. And I'm like, well, I'll make it within 10. I mean, at that point, we're finally kind of getting out of the traffic, and I'm like, well, you know, we're going to get there in time for that. I was going in the airport expecting that I was going in to cancel my flight, but then, you know, we just gave it, you know, just
nice.
Kind of whatever. So, yeah, so we get on the plane and we're like both out of breath. I want to include also kudos to the little girl working the cash register. That 7 minutes also includes me stopping and buying two bottles of water right before we got to our gate.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So she did it quick. I'm like, can you scan these really, really fast? I got to go. And anyway, so yeah, so he's like, yeah, you know what all this means? We're going to kill a booner. I'm like, this is just meant to be. So it's kind of like the video of the hat. It didn't happen, but it was fun. And you're right. If anybody finds themselves in that situation, I've been on hunts before where I was supremely confident. And that's, you know, one of the reasons that I decided to make this hunt was because I was very confident in the odds. And, you know, this property's not been bothered at all. Nobody's hunted it. Nobody's even really been on it that much other than the farmer and my buddy up there running cameras a little bit. and I'm like, this, you know, as good of odds as I can. And I've been on hunts where I was just disappointed. In this one, just I'm not, but for a lot of the same reasons that you talked about. I made the decision, and it was a blast to go and sit in a tree and get to enjoy that mm-hmm. kind of weather, and just, you know, it was all good. So,
well, that's a great topic, a fantastic topic, confidence, and I learned a big lesson last year. I think when I told the story about me shooting my first buck from the ground, I remember sitting there I put my M7 low on a tree, and I was actually sitting on the platform leaning back against the seat that was folded down. I had some palmettos in front of me. It's 4:08 p.m. in November, so it gets dark in like 39 minutes, right? And I remember being there like, this is a waste of time. You're late. You're an idiot. You're not going to see anything. And your daughter's birthday party is tomorrow, and you're going to be in trouble for staying at the camp tonight. Like, just all these reasons why I shouldn't be hunting. And I killed that buck. And so, and then that happened another time also on a big, like, low confidence hunt. And it reminds me that your feelings have no bearing on the behavior of the environment around you. Exactly. Nothing whatsoever. You can have, like you said, you can feel extremely confident and see nothing. See three squirrels, your favorite, you know? But anyway,
Damn squirrels.
There's laugh track. That's a whole topic for another day, is confidence and lack of confidence. It doesn't matter. It's all irrelevant, you know?
Yeah.
But I will say, and we've actually never talked about this on the podcast. I don't think we've ever brought up New Orleans ever, because most people in the state, New Orleans is the outlier city. It's not Louisiana, right? It's like a major city that Louisiana is around. And I went to college in New Orleans. I lived in New Orleans for 8 years. I got my house got robbed 3 times. That New Orleans is a terrible place that will always keep you down and always keep you, you know, under the thumb of the city. I cannot believe that you went through the gauntlet somehow and actually had great service and a good experience in that city, because
I've never been through any airport like that.
My favorite part of New Orleans is leaving. I can't stand it.
I agree. Only thing I can figure is the traffic was so bad, everybody else was missing their flights too. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, let's get on to talking about Brian and his hunts and whatnot. So
yeah.
Before we do that, I wanna ask you some questions though, Brian, before we get into your hunts. And we're gonna start doing this from now on. I wanna talk about gear. Mm-hmm. What are you shooting? What's your bow? Did you change anything? And what arrows are you shooting? Like, are you making any changes for this year? I understand that's more than one question, but yeah. Tell us about your gear this year. What's your choice of gear this year?
Yeah. So I didn't change bows, Vertix, I'm shooting a Matthews Vertix, arrows. I changed, was Easton Axis 4mm arrows, mm-hmm. With a 250 spine. So I'm drawing 70 pounds, 30 inches. 30-inch draw, and also shooting a fixed broadhead. Montex, the D5 Montex.
Okay. Are they one? You said 125?
No, 100 grain.
100. Okay, gotcha.
Yep, D5 Montex.
So why did you change arrows?
Well, I think just curiosity. So being on obviously the Facebook page, you see a bunch of stuff going back and forth as far as FOC and as far as the weight of arrows and all that kind of stuff. I'd never paid attention. You've probably seen some comments from me on there where I'm like, I just, buy a Carbon Express Maxima Red and put on 100 grain, a broadhead and
send her home,
and go hunting. So never really paid attention to weight, anything like that. And so, there's a lot of people that believe in the difference that all of that makes. I just figured this year I was going to pay a little bit more attention to it and see if it could make a difference, especially when I was headed out west where I knew there's a potential to have a 70 or 80 yard shot on an elk. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of want to give myself the best opportunity. So arrows, the decent access 4mm arrows. And I think we weighed them at 470 grains, which I don't think is real heavy, but it's also, you know, not real light.
Pretty average. So.
Yep. And so, but that's what I felt comfortable with. I mean, I sat here in the backyard for months, getting up in the morning before work and shooting out to, you know, 70 and 80 yards and then doing the same thing in the afternoon and got real comfortable, you know, with that setup. I also changed my release. I was using one of those, I don't know what you would call them, where they, it's just kind of like a clamp, you know, like a
caliper,
caliper. Yeah.
Yeah. And, so I was using that. I've been using that for years, the same one, for years. And I switched over to one of those that just has the hook, and it just seems a little more crisp, easier to get onto, you know, my D loop and stuff. And so switched that up. And, honestly, I feel a lot more confident, even though when we talk about my trip out west, it may not seem like it, but I feel a lot more confident in the way that I'm shooting.
Cool.
So when you swapped releases, did you have a different point of impact when you swapped releases?
Yeah, I think, we changed a lot of things whenever I swapped releases. There's more to the story. I had my bow set up, and the bow wasn't quite at a 30 inch draw when it should have been. So I was kind of compacted and having a little bit of trouble. So in the middle of switching releases, actually switching my release is what led to me figuring out that there was other adjustments that I needed to make to my bow, because it started eating up my D loop. And, I had some frays on the D loop already. I think it was just eating into that when I switched over to that different release. And so went up to get that replaced. And as I did that, found out that my draw length wasn't what it was supposed to be. And so got that fixed, which adjusted everything. And then at that point, you know, it's weird whenever you don't know that you're not set up correctly. And then you feel a little uncomfortable, you know, there's something wrong, but don't know what it is. And you wouldn't expect that your draw length isn't what it was supposed to be. And then all of a sudden everything comes together and how much difference it makes and how you're shooting.
Yeah. The reason why I asked was because I really love the idea of a hook release. I like, and this is why I like the idea of not having to take the eyes off the animal, your eyes off the animal, and then putting your release on by feel only. And not having to, you know, look at you, because when you have that caliper, you got to clip it on. So you got to give 2 seconds of your time, break your attention from the deer. And if it's a real tense situation, that might be a movement or that might be a poorly timed movement that could give you away or whatever. And, so I started shooting. I had a friend with one and had another friend with another one, and I shot theirs. And I was having way different point of impact, like 4 or 5 inches to the left, I believe. Mm-hmm. And then when I switched to this other one, it was only 3 inches to the left. And so ultimately I was like, you know, I don't have a problem. I don't need to fix this problem. I was hoping I could add this other advantage, if you will. Mm-hmm. And ultimately I kind of backed away from it. I was like, no, I'm good with what I got. I'm good.
Yeah.
So,
I'll tell you, I feel like as far as shooting, just a lot crisper with that new release, you know, like, I don't know, just, I really like it a lot more than I do with the caliper.
Cool. Well, so you went to Montex, you went to Fixed Blades for your big game hunt. Are you're sticking with those for deer season?
You know, I know we're going to get into that Kentucky hunt in a little bit, but that's what I use in Kentucky also. And it worked out really well. They seem to fly, you know, very, you know, accurate penetration. Obviously the only thing is there's a little bit of a question in my mind as far as, you know, blood trail and stuff like that. But as we get into that conversation, I think we'll find out that some of that has to do with me.
gotcha. So, okay. Yep. Well
my finger's been on the button waiting.
Oh yeah. Well, I can't wait to hear about your hunts. I wanted to get off on that foot though, because it's something that I want to talk to all bow hunter guests about, is What's your gear? Why? Why'd you pick it? Why'd you change? What are you thinking about changing? Et cetera, et cetera. Because we got to remember, this is a singular sport. This is a one man show, and we don't. It's not like we're you're in the duck blind with five other people asking people why they shoot one shell over another or one gun over another. Like we're up in a tree by ourselves.
Right.
We don't really get a whole lot of insight unless we're at deer camp together looking at people's bows hanging on the wall. But after the season starts, you're on an island. And so I want to make this a constant question that we ask moving forward. So tell us about – oh, wait. Hold on. Locke, you have to introduce our sponsor.
Yeah, so – if you listen to last week's podcast, our first episode of season 4, you will know that our guest is brought to you every week by Movement Mortgage and Brian Chamberlain. However, in this specific case, I'm not sure that I can tell you more about Brian Chamberlain than the man himself. So I'm gonna give him his own read. So tell us about you, Brian.
Yeah, all right. Well, I guess I'm supposed to talk about myself and mortgages, which is uncomfortable sometimes, but I'll go through it. So basically 19 years old. Got a job putting together furniture at a mortgage company, then answering phones, then got a loan officer license in 2001. And then for the last 20 years I've spent my career originating loans in the secondary market, buying loans from other banks and servicing them. And so it's building teams. And now I've got a branch in Mandeville, Louisiana, licensed in Louisiana, Texas, and Mississippi, where I've got a personal team where we originate quite a bit of loans. And then I manage production for a few other branches across the state of Louisiana. And I'll tell you about Movement Mortgage more than myself. I've worked for a few different companies throughout the years, and Movement is kind of a special company. It was started to fund a foundation. That foundation is a nonprofit, the Movement Foundation. So 40%, a little over 40% of our profit, every single deal that closes, every dollar that's made, 40 cents of that dollar actually goes to the Movement Foundation, where they're building hope centers in South America. They've got land in Uganda where they're teaching people how to farm. They're building charter schools for underprivileged areas across the country. So last year, $250 million was given to the Movement Foundation. So it's they say more than mortgages is kind of our slogan. And it's just kind of a cool deal to in the financial industry where you get a bad rap, especially after 2008, to be part of something where it truly is supporting a lot of things in the world that maybe, you know, are people in the world that don't have the opportunities that we have here in the United States.
Cool.
That's awesome.
So tell people how they can get in touch with you in your office.
Yeah, so the best, I answer my cell phone 7 days a week, 504-228-3780. That's the best way to get in touch. If it's a refinance, purchasing a home, if you are wanting to do a renovation loan, if you're impacted by a recent hurricane, we've got some programs with 100% financing for that purpose. Pretty much every program that's out there that we can do, and I've got a lot of experience with.
Well, awesome. I'll add this. I actually had my refi done by Brian, I don't know, maybe 4 to 6 months ago, I think. I think it was before the summertime, springtime. In my opinion, it was a very complicated situation. Brian says he deals with it all day long, and it was really no big deal. But I'm self-employed, and that is oftentimes challenging for getting refied or loans or approvals, et cetera, et cetera. And it was extremely easy. Dealt with Brian a lot of the times, his team some of the time for some of the admin side of things, and it was really great. So I highly suggest Brian. The only thing that I'll say is that when you send those update videos, you need to change shirts in between them. Okay, you gotta make it look like you filmed those on different days. All right.
Hey, Locke, that's actually part of something we need to talk about.
Yep.
So anyway, thanks, man. I appreciate you telling us about that.
Yeah. So we appreciate your support on the podcast, and if you're looking for any financial needs, contact Brian. Support one of our own, and Brian, we appreciate you introducing yourself. That was great.
Yeah.
And but what we wanted to talk about. So when we talked about my Missouri hunt, I didn't actually shoot anything, and I didn't have a chance to kill a velvet deer anyway because I say there's always a chance, I guess, but every deer on camera while I was up there had already lost their velvet. They typically do about that first week of September. And but you, on the other hand, have made a couple of hunts, and that's kind of the theme of the podcast, so to speak, is just talking about early season hunting and the different opportunities outside of our state where the weather's nicer this time of the year. So you went to Kentucky on a velvet hunt, and then you went out west to Utah, correct?
Yep.
On an elk backpack trip. So we want to hear, I guess, give us some stories and tell us a little bit how it went.
Yep. I think we got to start on kind of talking about how I got to Kentucky, because that wasn't part of the plan initially. So I'd been planning this elk hunt where we're jumping on horses and packing in with mules and going back, you know, 20 miles in the High Uintas Mountains in Utah. And Hurricane Ida started coming towards us, and we realized that was going to hit us basically head on. So that did, and that hit us the weekend before I was supposed to leave to go to Utah. So I canceled, you know, that Utah trip. We're here with generators. I got all my wife's family at the house, and I'm running to Mississippi to get gas and milk and back and forth every day, just trying to keep everybody comfortable here. And so I canceled that trip. And as we started to get things back together, get things cleaned up, and, we're about to get power back on, a buddy of mine was headed to Kentucky for a hunt. And I was talking to him. I was like, you know, I'm not going to be able to make my elk hunting trip, which I've been looking forward to all year. I think I'm just going to jump in the truck with you and head to Kentucky. And so I did that. And, we went up there and spent a few days, and it was slow for the most part. But on the last day of that hunt, well, back up, a couple days before that hunt ended, I got a call from two of the guys that Carlin and Andrew that were supposed to go on that elk hunt with me that had actually gone. They don't, one lives in Nashville, one lives in Pennsylvania. And, so they had actually gone, and I get this phone call from them when they get out of the woods talking about how they were covered up in elk. Andrew shot a bull, Carlin shot a bull, but didn't recover it. But they're just covered up in elk and got me all pumped up. And so I get a text from Rusty, the guy that we were going with, that says, "Hey, if you can be here on the 9th, we're going to go back in if you want to go." And so I text my wife. She never texts me back. She wasn't really excited about it, and said, "Hey, Rick's dropping me off at the airport in Lexington when we're done here, and I'm going to fly to Utah, and my buddy Steve is going to meet me there. He lives in the Florida Keys, but he's going to meet me there. I got my camera gear with me. He's going to film, and we're going to head into the woods, and I'll be off the grid for a week." So finished up the hunt in Kentucky, ended up shooting a decent 8-point. I never shot a velvet buck before. I think you probably saw it. I posted on Louisiana Bow Hunter on the Facebook community page. Ended up shooting that deer on the last hunt of the last day in Kentucky, and then jumping on a plane out of Lexington and flying to Utah. And I'm glad that I did, even though, you know, obviously my wife, she works with me on my team at Movement, but we also have three little girls and everything else that she does, you know, for us. So it's kind of a little bit of a, you know, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't have done it, but I'd just been looking forward to that trip, you know, all year long, and kind of hearing the excitement from Andrew and Carlin. And anyways, I had to go, and I'm glad I did, because it was probably, no, not probably, it was the best hunt that I've been on. I mean, you think about an adventure, you know, you think about, and you watch a lot of the YouTube videos and stuff like that, and you think about screaming elk and all this kind of stuff. And I'd been the last 4 years just, you know, we usually go into Colorado. I've got a little spot down there where I've killed one elk, just a cow elk, you know, but we're hiking in 7 miles on foot and just hanging out for a week and trying to figure it out, do it yourself over the counter, all that kind of stuff. But this was an opportunity to really get in there and have an opportunity at a big bull. And so I got a camera guy, a plan to film an awesome hunt. We fly in, we meet up, we drive to the trailhead, we load up on horses. And the guy asked me, he's like, you know, have you ever, you know, you're familiar with horses? I was like, yeah, I mean, I've seen them before. I rode one in high school, and I'm 40 now. And so we're about to ride 20 miles over some mountain ranges and all kinds of stuff. And I'll tell you what, I came out of there a horseman. I had a horse almost die of colic, where we had to like get it up and walk it. It didn't want to get up, and just all kinds of crazy chaos going on. And as we get back in the woods, we get set up. And day one, we get up about 5 o'clock in the morning. We're going to hike about 3 miles, you know, to get to this. They call them a bali, which is basically like a baldy. We're up at an altitude where you know, the mountains up top are just kind of rock slides and bald, and then it gets down to like where it meets up with the timber. And there's like vegetation there, and I guess those elk really like being up against that bald mountain inside the timber with a lot of vegetation they can feed on and stuff. And so we're making a loop to get down into the right wind position to start working our way back toward camp. So we hike about 3 miles or so. We get down there. We hear some rocks crumbling in the woods, and I can see some legs of elk walking about 60 yards in the woods. So we get set up. Steve drops back, who's my buddy that's filming this. He drops back, you know, maybe like 15 yards behind me, behind a log into a tree, just kind of get some cover with the camera. I'm up front in position. Rusty drops back about 60 or 70 yards and starts cow calling. And this is day one, you know, in the morning hunt. And all of a sudden, we probably have 20 or 30 cows that are just covering us up to the point where I can't move. I'm looking at them out of the corner of my eye to the point where my eye actually hurts because I can't move my head. I'm looking out of the corner for so long. And the coolest part about it is this is why you don't invite your buddy that's a vegan to come be your cameraman.
He's a vegan? Happens. Is that what you said?
He's not really. He gets pissed when I call him a vegan because he's like, dude, I wear leather belts. I'm whole food plant based. And so he had a weight problem and decided to go that route, and he lost like 60 pounds. And so, but he'll eat a hamburger with you when he's drunk. But anyway, he's back here. I'm thinking we're getting the best footage ever. I got cows at 8 yards. They're all over us. Anyways, and they kind of move on. They get a little bit spooked and they move on. I turn around with a big smile on my face. I'm like, hey, Steve, did you get that? He's like, get what? I'm like, you didn't get any of that? He's like, oh, no, I didn't want to.
Oh, man. That's
bad. Yes. Yes.
Like, you got to be kidding me, dude. So it gets better. We get up out of there and we now get back on track where we were headed to. And no, the bulls aren't bugling the first few days that we're there. But we get on track. We go. We got to cross a little creek. This creek is probably 10 feet across some rocks that, you know, you'd think if you're carrying a few $1,000 in camera gear and there was a slippery rock and the water wasn't that deep, that you just sacrifice a wet boot. But not Steve. Steve's got to put his hand down with a camera in it and dunk my entire camera underwater.
What? So,
no, man.
So my camera's toast. Real. All my stuff is toast. And it's about 2 hours into the first day that we're there. And so, and I would like to be upset with Steve, but I spent most of my 20s broke. And Steve was always there to buy me a beer. So I had to think about it that way and just kind of shake it off. That happens. We get back to camp. You know, it's all just beautiful up there. We're really just kind of taking everything in. You start to realize, man, we just rode horses 20 miles back to get here. First hunt, we're covered up in elk. Second hunt, we're in elk. Third hunt, we're in elk. Some smaller bulls, cows, spikes. Fourth hunt, we're in elk. And then we get to this, maybe it's the third day, the evening hunt. we get down into this new area, so we're going to go check out. As soon as we get down there, we got bulls bugling. And there's like four of them that are bugling. And, you know, I've hunted elk for 4 years. I've heard some bugles, but not like this, where they're just going crazy. They got a hot cow, and I'm sitting across the meadow from them. They're up in the timber. I'm probably, you know, 80 yards across the meadow. And I can see them up there. They're about 120 yards away from us. They're in the timber, going nuts. And there's a, in my mind, a giant. It's probably, he says probably a 320-inch, you know, 6x6. And it's in there. And we drop back, get in position, cow call. We can't get them away from that hot cow, obviously. And that hot cow starts moving away from us. So we gotta kind of move and figure out how we're going to get on them. And so we're running around, getting into the right wind position. We got to go all the way around this meadow, come up. It probably is an hour and a half or 2 hours of trying to work ourselves into this position. And I've been doing nothing but thinking about 70 and 80 yard shots on elk at my house and shooting that way constantly. But there was not much that could prepare me for running uphill and bulls bugling, screaming everywhere, and running uphill and having to stop behind trees. And then we would move when he would bugle. We'd move when he was raking something. We'd always move when there was noise to get closer and closer. And I wasn't expecting it, but all of a sudden Rusty's like, all right, Brian, 55 yards, knock an arrow, shoot, shoot, shoot. And I look, and I've got a lane that's about 3 feet wide, 55 yards. And I take a shot and I watch that arrow just bury in him, but high. And so basically I hit him about 8 inches below the top of his back, perfectly in the crease, but just too high, and not a drop of blood. Broke my arrow off with about 10 inches of penetration, but I think I just hit him in no man's land. And so we spent the next day grid searching, looking everywhere for him, hours and hours and hours, but never recovered him. So we determined that, you know, it's no man's land. Someone's going to find that or shoot that bull at some point. He's going to have an arrow in him, or it's going to fall out somewhere, and he's going to be fine. So we go back to camp, and, you know, I'm obviously bummed. You know, you work your butt off all year long. You've just hiked all over the place for 3.5 days, you know, probably 12 or 13 miles a day for that one opportunity, and then you mess it up. And so I'm kind of bummed, but I also know I've got some hunting ahead of me. And so we kind of suck it up and start hunting again. And the last day, the morning of the last day, we head out, and about a mile away from us or so, we hear bugles firing off. And so we start running. We get over into position, and just as we're coming through that volley that I spoke about earlier, we're coming through. There's a big rock ledge above us, and a 4x4 comes up top. He's about 45 yards. I ranged him, drew on him, but he turned and kind of trotted off. They're still bugling. I get set up, and Rusty drops back probably about 60 yards, and I'm set up. I got a rock on my right side, and I got a tree on my left side, and there's a small meadow. It's probably 100 yards across, like a finger of meadow that goes into the timber on my right-hand side. And in front of me, there's a ledge where it kind of drops off, and there's a bull bugling probably about 80 yards in front of me. We're trying to call him in, and a calf comes running across that meadow, stops about 2 or 3 feet in front of me, right in front, like I could reach out and pet it. And it's just looking in all directions, looking for that cow call. And I'm like, oh my gosh, what do I, you know, I can't move. This thing is literally right here. So I'm just trying to be perfectly still. And then a raghorn comes behind that cow about 30 yards, stops, it's looking around, and it starts trotting off in front of me. And I've got one gap, and I got a decision to make. Do I wait and try to shoot the bigger bull, or what I think is a bigger bull? I haven't seen it, but I could hear it. That's 80, 100 yards ahead of us that we haven't been able to draw in yet. Or do I shoot this 4x4? You know, that's coming through, and I'm going to have a 27-yard shot, you know, through this gap. And so I draw back. And that little calf had kind of stepped with its head in front of that tree on my left-hand side, draw back, and it kind of runs off. And that 4x4 walks through that gap. And in hindsight, I'd have tried to stop him. But I timed it, and I shot. And when I shot, I mean, I hit him hard. And he takes off running up the hill till I can't see him anymore. I'm watching, trying to figure out where he's going. Go and look at my arrow. And as I go to look at my arrow,
45 yards out in that meadow, that big bull comes across, big 5x5, comes across and stops broadside at 45 yards. And so I'm looking at that. I'm thinking, man, I just took the shot on the smaller bull. Maybe I should have waited. I go over and pick up my arrow, and it's absolutely drenched in blood, just dripping in blood, and blood all over the place. I'm like, okay, this thing's toast. 60 yards, no more blood, just specks. Grid searching for hours, and no recovery. And that's how my hunt ended.
So, do you know? I mean, could you tell where you hit it? Like, I mean,
I think I hit him in the liver. I think that because you don't realize those they travel even when walking. And it's funny because there's a guy in camp with us that is an attorney in Chicago, and real like intellectual, almost annoyingly intellectual guy, but a nice guy. And he actually was doing some calculations, and we figured out like it's very possible that an elk walking, you know, from the time that arrow, you know, leaves my bow till it hits him, very well could have moved 12 inches, you know, to where I think what happened is instead of stopping him, I tried to time it and I just hit him a little bit back. I think I got liver and he's dead somewhere. Yeah, it's just somehow that plugged up, that blood stopped, and we just weren't able to find him. You know, those things can move so quick, you know, and cover so much ground. You just don't know where they've gone if you don't have blood.
Yeah, that's not fun. That's a difficult story. I guess this might be a pointless question, but do you feel like there was a broadhead that would have put the animal down, or do you think it's just the shot placement?
I mean, obviously, if I put that arrow through his lungs, he'd have fallen in sight. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what it comes down to. That broadhead, I shot that for penetration, just because they're a big animal. And I think that broadhead would have done its job perfectly had I done my job perfectly. But is there a broadhead that could make up for me not doing my job perfectly? I don't know the answer to that question. Very well could be. You know, do you give up penetration for a mechanical that's got a wider cutting, you know, diameter? You know, maybe, you know, but you hope that you make a good shot and not a questionable shot. So I don't know. I mean, it's possible.
Yeah, well, I've always, going all the way back to when I worked in an archery shop years ago, and these kind of questions seem to be, especially around August, September, when everybody's gearing up for the fall, these questions pretty much seem to happen with nearly everyone that you ended up talking with in the shop that came in, but I obviously wasn't there to experience your situation, but what you said, and I've said it on the podcast before, what you said is how I view things. I mean, I wouldn't go as far as to say that there aren't bad products on the market and that kind of thing, but if you shoot an animal through the lungs, you know, if you can shoot a lot of different things in terms of broadheads and arrows and weights and all these different things, speed even, all this stuff. But if you make a good shot, it all becomes a little bit, I don't know what's the word, not irrelevant, but yeah. It's all about that. So I agree with you. I don't think that there's one of the biggest beefs that I have with a lot of the marketing I see when it comes to archery equipment is it seems like, I don't want to say recently or nowadays or anything like that, but but I guess that's the only thing I can say. It feels like the marketing has trended towards this kind of ease of use performance kind of thing where, you know, don't worry about it. If you shoot this, it's going to take care of it. You know, this is going to do the job for you no matter what. And that's just not the case because, I mean, an animal that big, even if you shoot it with a wide cutting head, if you hit it back and it's like you said, it's moving and you hit it that far back, you're rolling the dice. Maybe maybe the cut is more effective, and maybe he goes down due to blood loss in a way that you might have found him in that grid search, as opposed to him getting far enough away that you couldn't find him in grid search, but you still, it's still just a coin flip at best.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, the what you were saying about the elk walking and you know, like you said, calculating how far it would have walked and the time frame that it took for your arrow to get there, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very unpopular thing to talk about in bow hunting is the reality that we lose animals. You know, and that's not unique to just bow hunting. Rifle hunters lose animals all the time. You shoot them with a shotgun, lose them. You shoot them with an atlatl and lose them. A lot of times, though, bow hunters will experience the loss more heavily. It maybe is the best way I can say it, because we have an arrow to give us feedback. If you're shooting a deer, if you're shooting an elk or a deer with a rifle, a bullet, if there's nothing but a pile of hair on the ground or a couple of spots of blood, obviously you can't go check your bullet to see if you gut shot or see if you hit liver or see if you got bubbles on it and it's pink and you hit lung or leg blood or whatever. And so a bow hunter seems to like endure the actual loss of an animal more than a rifle hunter, I think, because we have feedback and we're standing at the shot of impact because it's a lot closer most of the time. It's not hundreds of yards away potentially. And, you know, I guess what I'm getting at is losing animals is part of hunting. It's a terrible part of hunting that we all want to try to avoid. But we have to remember that there's an animal in this equation also. It has its own variables that it's throwing at us. And honestly, your story on shooting while it's walking sounds Locke, I don't know if you picked up on this. Sounds exactly like your buck that you found in the pond 2 years ago.
I was thinking that while you were talking.
Y'all both said the exact same thing. I should have stopped him in hindsight. I wish I did, and he steps forward, and I hit further back than I wanted to. You both said the exact same thing. And now, granted, Brian was a further shot on a larger animal, but ultimately the result was the same. So, you know, and it, of course, you've got that regret of I should have stopped him, but I don't like stopping animals personally. I think it alerts them. It could lead to string jump. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
It's a whole nother problem you introduced. And so there's no right answer. I'm sorry you lost animals. It's a part of it. I had a terrible year a few years ago where I lost a lot of animals. I felt like the worst hunter. I felt unworthy to go hunt animals. It's terrible. But, you know, you learn from it. You overcome it. Like y'all are talking about broadheads, there is no elixir broadhead that will fix all of your shot placement problems. It doesn't exist. But it kind of leads back to what my ultimate perspective of bow hunting is, which is that we should all be working on being better woodsmen, hunters, and better equipped personally to make great shots. Then we should be trying to fix our problems with equipment. You know, this isn't golf when we're trying to fix our slice. You can fix your slice, you know, and it just takes a little bit of extra effort. But also, like I said earlier, it's early season. You got the jitters. You flew out there on a whim, you know. Plus, an elk is one of the few animals that talks back to you. It's like a giant turkey, you know. Right. So, I mean, I don't fault you or anything. I don't want you to ever go through it again, but I wasn't there. I can't say anything that, you know, anything about the situation or that it could have been different or anything like that.
I'll tell you the lesson, because, you know, when you're in the middle of nowhere, you know, everybody's either sitting by a fire. There's only a few people there. They're either sitting by a fire. You get a lot of time. It's not like you go hunting and then you go back to the office and you got a bunch of other stuff on your mind. And not to say that even in that scenario, you're not sitting and just kind of rethinking everything, replaying everything. But I'll tell you this, next year when I go, because I'm going to go on the same trip because it was an awesome trip. I think it's just kind of a maturity thing as far as,
as far as patience. Like, it's okay if you don't take that shot in that gap and that elk gets away. You know, so like, and honestly, if I was mature enough at that point to say, you know what, that's not the elk for me. There's another one here. Hopefully I'll get an opportunity. That's not the best shot. Let them walk. And then, I would have had a 45 yard shot with a broadside 5x5 nice elk in a meadow that wasn't even looking at me or paying attention to me had I not taken that shot. And so, you know, in my mind, for next year, I got to be willing to let that animal go and hope for another opportunity, as opposed to thinking, man, I just came 20 miles. I just ran a mile. I just got here. He's right there. I have to take this shot. You know, I think that's the big lesson that I learned from it.
I think that I think that's great, because I think that in a smaller way, that can translate to even the guy who maybe says, you know what, I've got stuff with the family next weekend. I'm not going to be able to go next weekend. You know, I don't have a lot of time to hunt, et cetera, et cetera. And they take a questionable, you know, for the same, the same kind of pressure. And I think you're right. I think it's fair, thing to say that we all should maybe kind of look at it from this perspective, that if you, let's just use the example. It's a little different than your elk, but you know, let's use the example of the private land hunter that's targeting a specific deer or a couple of specific deer, and they're on the property. And you know, if you take a questionable shot or you rush a shot, maybe it's not so much a questionable shot, but you rush it because you feel like if this is, it's now or never. Well, if you do that and you wound the animal or you scare the crap out of the animal, then the never part becomes much more of a reality than if you let him just chase that doe on by and keep hunting him and wait for a better opportunity. I think that what you said applies to a whole lot of situations. I've learned that myself. I've not so much as a bow hunter, not so much in terms of shooting and losing animals. I mean, I've done that. I've taken bad shots. I've rushed shots, and I've wounded deer. I mean, I think anybody who hunts long enough is gonna be able to say that. But more so than that, I feel like looking back, I have messed up places, messed up spots, messed up plans by hunting with urgency when it wasn't necessary. That I'm in that deer's home. He lives there. Right. You know, he's going to be there. There's going to be another day. And I've made decisions in the stand and tried to make things happen and ended up scaring deer off. Or maybe you could even boil that down to maybe even kind of forcing your way into a spot that's not the right day to be doing that and messing them up and never having an opportunity or never getting another opportunity. Yep. So, yeah, I think that's prevalent. And bow hunting is...
Well, what? Go ahead.
No, I was just say, patience is a big part of bow hunting. Should be.
I'll tell you what. Hurts a lot. That I know that everybody says this, but I'll tell you, after that happened, and we're sitting there, and everything's kind of gloom and doom, and I'm sitting on a rock in the middle of the woods with a bunch of horses that we had taken over there so that we could take this elk out of the woods, and we didn't find him. When somebody says, "That's bow hunting." And I know people say that all the time, but I was like, man, I just don't want to hear that phrase right now. Mm-hmm. You know, that's bow hunting. Mm-hmm. It's the truth, but it just sucks to hear that, because you know at that point it's done. You know, like that's bow hunting. Yeah. You know.
Yep.
So anyway,
well, let's move on. Let's move on to another topic that I want to go over with the two of y'all, which is, we're 1 week out from the season, or less than 1 week out. It starts this week. What are your goals this year for this hunting season? I know you both of y'all have already traveled. Y'all make me feel like I'm a poor person over here. But are you going places? Are you wanting to try and hunt a different style? Do you want, you know, what are your goals? Tell me what your goals are, Brian.
I've got a goal of two
4-year-old or better bucks this year. That's my goal. One of them I'm hoping to happen in Missouri on some public land that I'm going to hunt. One of the things I'm doing this year, last year, and you know this, Kyler, because you set a date to go to the Midwest to go hunt, mm-hmm. and the weather doesn't cooperate. So this year I'm setting a approximate time that I'm going to go to Missouri, and then I'm just going to play weather patterns and go whenever the weather's right, as opposed to setting a date in stone. So my goal is this, to kill a public land buck in Missouri, 4-year-old or better, and then also on our property, on our private land, our lease, to do the same.
Nice. Locke, what are yours?
So, well, I mentioned in the last podcast, I don't remember exactly what we were talking about, maybe new things or something like that, but I'm going to stick to, one of my goals is to be successful while sticking to my more mobile strategy with my new mobile lock-on setup. That's kind of a small, I don't know so much of that's a goal as it just, I don't know exactly how to classify it, but as far as, I guess, other things, I want to make sure that I get my son an opportunity to shoot a deer with his bow. This is the first year he's old enough to really bow hunt.
That would be exciting.
That's one big goal. And then I'm doing the same thing. Brian and I actually talked about this on the phone earlier today, and I'm kind of doing the same thing because I think one of the things that all three of us have in common is we all went to the Midwest to hunt pre-rut or rut. Brian, you were a little earlier than Kyler and I. Kyler and I went the same week to two different places and all had pre-planned trips and all had terrible weather and didn't have good hunts. And so I'm doing the same thing. I'm going to go. I drew a Kansas tag, and I now have a Missouri license because I didn't fill my tag last week. So I definitely want to, probably more so than Missouri, I want to fill that Kansas tag. That's a big goal for me. That's a kind of a special tag to have. It's a special place to hunt that area of the country. I've mentioned it on the podcast before, and so I'm excited about that. And then I have not yet, since we bought the place, my parents bought a small piece of property in Mississippi where I'm from. It's right down the road from my sister, and it's about 50 acres, but it's a really good 50 acres in terms of hunting, in terms of the way it lays out. And I haven't killed a buck off of it yet, and I think it's been 8 years. I've passed a bunch, a couple I probably shouldn't have, and so I definitely have a goal to finally punch that card and kill a deer on my family property. So I guess those are kind of my goals. The other goal is to just slow down and start enjoying it. I feel like I'm constantly in a rush and busy all the time and squeezing it all in. And I want to try to go hunt with friends more where I can just relax and just hunt, you know, do that more. Yeah. What about you?
So, before I tell you my goals, I'll tell you all something that I think is kind of funny. I went in the woods for the first time today, like the all season, like literally in the woods. Like I'm talking like leaving concrete and walking into the woods. I haven't scouted a second. I only went to the woods to get my cell cameras that I left up on public land last year that I never went back and got. Found all three of those, you know, no issues. And, you know, I got running the cards in them, and they died about February or March. They stopped sending pictures. I think I have covert. So covert, I think they told me that once your battery gets below 10%, it stops transmitting, but it'll still take pictures. So we'll see what's on them. But I went in the woods for the first time today, and, you know, nothing's really more invigorating, and nothing gets you more excited for bow season like taking banana spider webs to the face all afternoon.
Oh, I love it.
So that got me pumped up again. So I'm you know, like Ronnie Dugas, he texted me after last week's episode. He goes, I'm glad to hear you're excited about bow season now. Like, I feel like I'm the last one. But I've been working on the camp so much that I haven't set foot in the woods until today. And the reason why I've been working on the camp was because I like having a lot of people at the camp. I like the party vibe, the hangout, public land, like let's like plan out where we're going to hunt for the weekend type thing. I want a lot of people to stay. I like the activity, et cetera, et cetera. And so I finally got the camp set up to where I can sleep six people comfortably with ACs, and you know, everybody's got a bed, et cetera, et cetera. And so I went and got my cameras. I haven't set any of them out yet. I have my spot set up for opening day, or opening weekend, as long as the wind stays. I think it's southwest, excuse me, which is a great wind for a couple of spots I have. So I don't really need to go in and find exact sign to set up on. I've got an area that I'm going to go to on Friday that I'm pretty pumped about. And so that's what I've been doing. But my actual goals, I actually have them written down here, so I can go back over this at the end of the season. Number one is I want to hunt from the ground more. That's really exciting. It's a totally different mindset from hunting out of a tree stand and trying to find the right tree. It's more about trying to find an area where you can hide within or beside or behind a cluster of trees or palmettos, whatever, and your best guess on where a deer is going to walk. But that's a really fun experience, so I want to hunt from the ground more. Secondly, I've never killed a deer over 140. I've killed a 139 and 5/8, and it was just like not 140. I want to kill a 140 plus on public land this year. So I'm going to be using my cameras only to essentially figure out what's in the area and where my time is best spent. I don't really use cameras to determine, you know, when to be where on, you know, what feature or whatever. I use them for inventory of an area, and then I go hunt the sign of that area. And if I don't see anything or I'm not getting anything, then that actually helps me stay away from places that aren't worth my time. But that's number two. Number three is, and I've told both of y'all this, I want to kill a deer with a crossbow, but I don't want to pull it back until I have a deer in range, which sounds crazy, but I think it's possible.
So that goal is only worthy if you have somebody film it. I'm just saying.
I don't disagree. That's going to be, I know that's, you're not wrong. You know what? That might be, I might have to do this on Levi's place. Okay. Cause I know Levi would love to be in a tree next to me, filming me do this.
I want to do it with my little laughter and wah-wah-wah buttons ready to be pushed.
I've spent far more time than anybody would ever want to spend on the phone with Jay James talking about the possibilities of this. Jay James thinks I'm an idiot for wanting to do this. Brian has offered to let me use his Raven. So, you know how Jay is. Jay's a harsh personality. You either love Jay or you wouldn't piss on him if he was on fire, right? Mm-hmm. And I've told Jay that to his face many times. He laughs. Every time I say it, he laughs real hard. JJ, he was like, that's the stupidest idea I've ever heard. You're an idiot. Why do you want to do that? And then you let him get that out of his system. And then he goes, I think I got a crossbow that'll work for it. He goes, I think I got one that you can pull back with your hands. You know, et cetera, et cetera. So I've got to work through the logistics of it. I obviously have to practice, but I think, you know, I told you I had a regret from last season. I wish I was more vocal about wanting to kill a deer from the ground, because I killed two last year and it was awesome. I'm teeing this one up. I want to kill a deer with the crossbow that I draw back while it's within crossbow range. And I don't mean like 100 yards crossbow. I mean like 60, 50, 40 yards type stuff. Right.
Okay.
I hope that I kill a 140 with the crossbow. knocked two of those off at one time. And then what's my last one? Hold on. This is a good one. This one's more strategy based. It's more organized based than it is, in the field. When it comes to deciding where to hunt, sometimes I get what I've coined as stand envy. Stand envy is when you're in one deer stand wishing you were in another deer stand. Okay. Oh, yeah. And so I am going to create a listing of all my hunting spots with my own, my own name, so there, I could put it on the wall of my camp and nobody will know what I'm talking about. It's a Three Oaks spot or, Double Trail or something. You know what I mean? Like, who knows where this is. And I want to have them listed by appropriate wind direction. And so when I get to the camp or I wake up and the wind shifted from the north to the southwest, I can be like, oh, I'm going to hunt, the grapefruit tree. I'm going to hunt, Moose Corner, and I'm going to hunt, Lactate Cove or something. I'm just making stuff up. So I think that's a good game plan to have because I don't know if many people listening are like this, but I have a really big problem of never going back somewhere ever again. Like, I'm always moving forward, like new ground, new spot. And the reality is, a place that I hunted 3 years ago still has deer on it. Why do I not go there anymore? It was great for an east wind. Why do you not go there when you have east wind? That's going to be more of an organizing, like getting my strategy together goal, but it's still worth mentioning as a goal to actually get that together. So yeah. Those are mine.
Cool.
So, very cool.
Well, we will all be embarking on this, I guess from the time we're recording here, like 5 days, what, 5-6 days?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yep.
It's
coming up.
Yeah. We've talked quite a bit this episode about, different hunting opportunities and hunting out of state. I want to take a minute to remind you to check out 180 Outdoors and hunt180.com. If you want to book an early season hunt next year, you're going to have to get in the Kansas lottery in April. But if you do, that's one of the things that 180 does, and they have a lot of success in the early season. And when you deal with Matt and the guys at 180, they've got fully guided, semi-guided, as well as private leases. And Matt's also a Mossy Oak Properties agent and can help you purchase a piece of land in Kansas as well. So anything you need in southeast Kansas and northern Oklahoma, any kind of hunting activity that you're interested in, turkey, deer, and waterfowl, and check them out at hunt180.com, and you can follow them on social media and kind of see what they've been doing and what kind of animals they've got on camera, as well as harvest reports. So check them out for your next Kansas adventure, hunt180.com. All right, guys, so a lot of stories being told already, and we haven't even got to October the 1st, so I'm excited about what's to come. You guys got anything else before we wrap up?
Yeah, I got one more thing. Need to go on the website, check out some of our new merch this year, and check out our sponsors also. Hit up Brian if you need some great refi or first-time home buyer, any sort of financial product like that for mortgages. Really great guy to work with and great team, so I highly suggest. That's all I wanted to say.
Appreciate you guys.
Yeah, Brian, we appreciate you coming in or coming on to the podcast, stepping in for us and telling your story. I think it's great timing as well. One of the active members of the community, and you go out west on elk hunt and have an exciting story to tell, so we appreciate you taking the time.
Yep. Thank you, guys.
All right, guys, so if we got nothing else, we will talk to you guys again this week. We're actually going to drop two podcasts this week, so be looking for our normal end of the week release, and get ready for October the 1st. It's coming. We'll talk to you guys later.
All right.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Louisiana Bowhunter Podcast. If you have anybody you'd like to hear on the show, reach out to us at info@louisianabowhunter.com. And if you want to help support Louisiana Bowhunter, go by your local archery shop and pick up some merchandise. If you don't have any at your local shop, let us know and we'll reach out to them. Or pick up your gear at louisianabowhunter.com and we'll ship it out to you same day. See you next week.